Chaza Bodine is a Yale graduate and Rhodes Scholar, and he's the son of Kathy Bodine and David Gilbert, members of the Weather Underground. His parents were in prison during his childhood for their part in the robbery of an armored Brinks truck that resulted in three murders. And he was raised in Chicago by Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, two other former members of the Weather Underground. Chaza fell in love with Latin America during a language study program in rural Guatemala while he was still in high school, and he has spent most of his adult life living, working, and traveling there. He's called his latest book, Gringo. It's published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You were only 14 months old when your parents were sent to prison. When did you come to understand what had happened?
Well, it was something I grew up with. I mean, I don't actually remember when I had my first conversation with my parents about it. It was always there. I started visiting them in prison before I can even remember.
Mm-hmm. So you were, at a certain point, you realized that going to prison was just a normal part of life?
Well, it was for me, and it actually is for millions of Americans who grow up with their parents in prison.
In the book you call Bernadette Dorn, Mom, how did you work out that relationship? Bernadine, why don't I call it Bernadette?
Well,
typo here.
Yeah, I have two mothers and two fathers, and I think it's not that unique, actually, in America where we have, or in the world in general, where many people grow up with divorced parents or with incarcerated parents.
And your mother was released from prison just 6 years ago, but your father's still in jail?
Correct.
Was it difficult to navigate the transition from the middle class life that you were living to visiting the prison system? Because most of the people who do visit prison are not, well, as privileged as you were.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. And I think, if anything, I was lucky to have as much support in navigating that divide as I had. And it was also something that prepared me really well for the travels and the experiences that I encountered in Latin America when
because,
I got older.
Because so much of what you are concerned about is class differences.
Yeah, class differences and different approaches to life and understanding the world. And that's one of the great things about traveling, what I fell in love with as soon as I hit the road in Latin America.
Was there also an element of escape, of living behind the complicated legacy of being your parents' child when you went there?
No question. I mean, one of the great things about traveling on your own is it forces you to make decisions on your own, away from the context of your friends and family, and it gives you the opportunity to reinvent yourself and decide who you want to be and how you want to define your own identity.
Did many people, anybody you met in Latin America, was anybody aware of your parents' story?
People who I became close with, friends or colleagues at work, knew about it. But the funny thing is, things that we take really seriously here in the United States that are important parts of our history may not resonate with Latin Americans in the same way. So most people in Latin America never heard of the Weather Underground, certainly. I could tell them my parents had been members of it, but it wouldn't mean anything to them. And that was also refreshing to give me a bit of a broader perspective on things that had been so defining in my own life, but which in the broader scheme of things may not be that important.
Does the class struggle in Latin America seem more consistent with the ideals and aspirations of the radical activists in the 60s in this country?
Well, certainly the political spectrum in Latin America is much wider and broader and more complicated in many ways than the one we have in the United States. I mean, the two-party system we have here is relatively narrow, and it doesn't have a lot of room for parties like that represent the ideas that my parents represented in the 1960s. Latin America, on the other hand, tends to have, depending on the country you're in, tends to have political parties that represent a really wide range of politics, and the center tends to be much further to the left in Latin America.
Although there are people who would tell you that the politics of your parents weren't so ideal, so maybe it's not such a bad thing that we don't see some of that in the country today. Mark Rudd has just written a book in which he kind of disavows much of the political thinking of that time.
Yeah, Mark Rudd's book just came out, and I'm looking forward to reading it. My book really, though, is about Latin America. It's not about the 60s. It's not about the politics in this country. It's about what I believe to be really exciting, current, contemporary changes happening across Latin America as a whole.
How old were you when you first went to Guatemala?
18.
Was the trip arranged through an organization?
No, I just set it up on my own. I found a language school through a friend and got in touch with them and arranged to go down there on my own.
And what was your original goal? To learn Spanish, or was it something else?
Basically, learn Spanish and to have a bit of an adventure. And actually, chapter one of my book about Guatemala is, you know, starts with me getting off the airplane and being a little befuddled, not knowing what to do, being scared and intimidated by the long bus ride ahead of me, and just trying to figure it out as I go.
The middle-class mothers on my staff were somewhat horrified that the program you were on didn't provide transportation for a 17-year-old. Yeah. I would assume that riding a bus in Guatemala wasn't the safest thing in the world at the time.
Well, I was certainly intimidated, and I think my mothers were both glad to hear about it after the fact rather than ahead of time. No question, some of my travels, the boat trip up the Amazon River as well, I think, was one of those examples where they were happy to hear the details after I was already safely home. But, you know, it was part of coming of age, and that's what I write about in the book, my own coming of age, in parallel to the changes happening politically across the region.
Did you know what to expect when you opted for bus transportation?
That first time, I had no idea what to expect. I, you know, was thinking about, I was in the airport. I was trying to figure out how to get to the language school in a rural town in northern Guatemala. And the information desk at the airport said to me, well, you can take a plane for $60 or you can take a bus for $12. And I was sitting here thinking to myself, well, I'm not really in a rush. I've got 3 days to get there, and the bus only takes 12 hours, so what the heck?
Did it take 12 hours?
Well, it broke down, and we had to wait for it to get fixed, which took about 5 hours. So it ended up being a little longer than I anticipated. But I found some friends on the bus next to me, some people who took me in and watched my stuff when I had to go get a bite to eat or go to the bathroom, that kind of thing.
And there was also other stuff. The driver made you check your luggage under the bus.
Correct.
Sometimes I'm uncomfortable doing that in the United States.
Yeah, no question. And it's something that I've dealt with. I've now bussed across all of Latin America and South America and much of the Caribbean. I've, you know, been to dozens of countries, and pretty much everywhere I travel by bus. And I definitely get anxious sometimes when I put my luggage under the bus. I have the good fortune to have never actually been robbed. So I'm afraid my anxiety is not well-founded, in fact.
One of the motifs of this book is the distinctive traditions of travel in Latin America and your experiences with local transportation systems. Do most people travel by bus?
Well, yeah, most people who can afford to travel can't afford to travel by plane. And, you know, so part of the point of this book is, and of my travels in general, was to reach out and understand and give voice to the majority of people in Latin America. The elites who can fly usually speak English and have access to international media and can publish their opinions and make their views known around the world. The people who can't travel at all or who can only afford to travel by bus are the ones that I wanted to reach out and understand in this book.
I've had mixed experiences in Mexico. I was told to get a first-class seat in a bus going from Mexico City to some place, I can't remember. And on the way back, I asked for a first-class seat, and the person selling the tickets looked at me and said, "We don't recognize class here."
Well,
I got a little dressing down as a gringo.
You know, it's funny. Things like that do happen. My first week at the University of Chile when I was studying abroad, I had a similar experience. I walked into class, and I spoke a bit of Spanish at this point. And one of my classmates said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said to him in Spanish, "I'm American." And he looked back at me a little befuddled and said, "Well, I'm American too. We're all American, you know, South America, North America." You know, so that definitely you have those experiences, and you learn from them and you laugh at them.
Is that where the word gringo comes in to play?
Yeah, I mean, it's
gringo means people from the United States.
Yeah, or foreigner. And I write a little bit in the introduction to the book about the origins of the word and the way it's used. And obviously, obviously it can be used in a way that's pejorative and offensive, but for the most part it's used simply as a descriptive term to say, you know, the one who's not from here, the outsider. And I found it was used as often as not as a term of affection for me.
My guest is Cesar Bodin, whose book Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America, is published by Scribner. Were you treated differently in your travels because you're a gringo?
I think I was. I mean, there's something I write about in the book, and I call it the gringo wild card. And, you know, it's the perks and the special treatment and the privileges that I received, mainly because I was an outsider. So on that first bus trip in Guatemala, most people on the bus were standing up and didn't have seats. But they made sure that I had a seat, only because I was a foreigner.
Was there ever a temptation to go native, or is that impossible?
I certainly tried, and on many occasions. And, you know, of course, you do have the occasion where you'll be treated worse as a result of being a foreigner. And so I think it cuts both ways. But going native is an option to some extent. But you also are who you are, and I was always clear on my identity, and I've always been really grateful to be an American.
When did you go to Guatemala the first time?
It was in January of 1999.
So that you missed some of the worst problems that Guatemala had gone through. There had been a government that had pretty much been hunting down Mayans and other indigenous people.
Correct.
For a while.
Since the 1954 coup in Guatemala that overthrew the democratically elected government of Jacob Arbenz, there was a pretty brutal civil war that cost hundreds of thousands of lives.
And when did that end?
That ended in the, I forget the exact year, the late 1980s, but there was still ongoing violence. And in fact, even to this day, there is still some violence in Guatemala as a result of that legacy. But one of the things that was important for me in terms of my travels there is growing up with parents that had the political perspective mine had. It meant that when I arrived in Guatemala, I was already aware of the history, the role the U.S. and the CIA had played in supporting the coup against the Arbenz government. And it really shaped the way that I approach my travels in Guatemala and beyond.
There's a play now by Angela Davis's niece talking about growing up in a radical household and how that both has a positive and a negative effect. In some cases, it can also lead you to have a rather stereotypical view of the world, can't it?
I guess so. For me, though, it was always a question of trying to stretch and expand my view, and I didn't ever feel that I was surrounded by dogma or imposed ideology. I felt that I had, the opportunity to understand the world from multiple viewpoints and then to figure out and try to make sense of my own perspective.
You mentioned that the 1980s were particularly rough for Guatemala. They were pretty rough for most of Latin America, weren't they? It's been called the lost decade.
Yeah, that's right. The economic policies that were, to a large extent, imposed on the region through leverage and a bit of arm twisting from international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, along with the complicity of local politicians and elites, meant that the region was dominated by recession, stagnation, and often political violence as well. And one of the exciting things that I try to document in my book is the way the region has rebounded from that period in the last decade since I started traveling in Latin America.
Don't many people in Latin America blame neoliberals for many of their problems? Why do you think that phrase is so commonly used in Latin America and almost unknown here?
It's a funny thing. You know, I write about it in my book as well. When I was in college, all my friends in Latin America would talk about neoliberalism as the cause of their economic problems. My roommate in college said that word doesn't even get recognized by my spell check in Microsoft Word. And, you know, how can you use that word? I think it's like many things. It's a shorthand for a more complicated series of policies, which you could call by any number of names. But the reality is people in Latin America, throughout Latin America, have time and time again elected leaders who say they will do one thing, and once in office basically impose a series of policies known as neoliberal policies, which are straight out of Washington. And that resulted arguably in the Argentine economic crisis. It resulted arguably in the 1980s being known as the lost decade throughout Latin America. And it led in large part to the resurgence of a new left across Latin America that we're seeing today.
You're saying American policies caused all the problems? Wasn't Jimmy Carter a key figure in bringing democracy back to South America especially?
Well, let me clarify. I don't think that American policy caused all the problems. I think there's no question that Latin America and Latin Americans have their share of responsibility. I think as Americans...
The Perón wasn't invented by the United States.
Exactly, nor was Pinochet. So there's no question that Latin Americans have their share of responsibility. I think as a U.S. citizen, however, and as a taxpayer in this country, it's my role, it's our role to question the culpability or the responsibility that our government may have.
You wound up going to Chile in 2001, then later to Argentina, because you were curious about the politics?
Well, I was in Chile on a Rotary International Ambassadorial Scholarship. The local Rotary Club in Connecticut, where I was in college, sent me as an ambassador to the University of Chile for a year. And that's what initially brought me to Chile. And once there, I decided to travel a bit and explore the region.
You also chose not to live in the nice neighborhood that had been set up for you.
Correct. Yeah, I felt that the homestay that I was initially set up on was a little too much like geographically removed but culturally contiguous extension of the United States. And I really wanted to experience a bit more of your average Chilean's lifestyle.
Were you there on September 11, 2001?
I was, yep. I had just been there for about a month and a half at that point.
Now, it was pointed out in some news stories that September 11th has a whole other significance for people in Chile.
Yeah, and I learned, sort of the hard way. I was trying to go to class that morning at my campus at the University of Chile, and when I arrived, I saw a huge battle going on between protesters, many of whom were my classmates, and the police, and there were water tanks, and tear gas was flying, Molotov cocktails were exploding, rocks came whizzing by my head, and it wasn't until a couple hours later that I got a phone call from my mother in the United States telling me about the tragedy here.
But what was the fight going on there? Pinochet, was he still in power?
He was not in power, but it was the anniversary. September 11th, 1973 is the day that Pinochet took power and overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. And the thousands that were tortured, the as many as millions that were exiled in the aftermath of that coup, again, a coup which was supported by the CIA, and the documents have been declassified to reveal the facts. That coup, is something that still resonates very strongly with Chileans, especially those who had a loved one, a family member tortured or killed.
You brought back a poster that had been plastered all over Santiago, Chile,
yeah.
Which kind of was trying to put things into perspective.
Yeah, it was. I think an expression of at least one group, one political current's outrage at what they viewed as the ongoing atrocities around the world, and it was basically pointing out that on September 11th, 2001, in addition to all the people who so tragically died here in New York and in Washington, there were tens of thousands of children who died of preventable causes around the world, and that the level of outrage and response from the world community, from the global community, was really lacking.
Still, Chile has not moved very far to the left.
Chile is an interesting case because the politicians that govern Chile have and their ideology has been relatively consistent since the transition back to democracy. But in the last presidential election, a woman was elected, Michelle Bachelet, and it's the first ever woman to be president in Chile. And I think, what she represents is a huge cultural shift, if not a political one. Her policies may not be that different than her predecessors. Her political party certainly is the same as her predecessors. However, Chile is an unbelievably conservative country. When I was first there in 2001, the law didn't allow for divorce. There was no way to get divorced in Chile. That has since changed. But to have a woman like Michelle Bachelet, who is a single mother, a divorcee now, and also the daughter of a prominent official in the Allende government who was killed and tortured by the Pinochet regime, is really a remarkable cultural shift for Chile.
Did you go to Argentina during their financial meltdown?
I did. Again, it was pretty much coincidental. I found myself on the streets of Buenos Aires in the midst of the 2001-2002 economic crisis in Argentina. And that's, again, one of the places where I learned about the outrage so many Latin Americans feel about what they call neoliberal economic policies.
And then you went back 2007. The situation's changed, but there again, the government is not a leftist government, despite the outrage you talk about. In fact, it's a Peronist government, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that I try to grapple with in my book is there's this growing coalition of governments in Latin America, which now include more than 10 different countries across the region, who are part of, as I said, part of a coalition of leftist or progressive or independent governments. They're not all the same. There's a big difference between the Kirchners in Argentina, Bachelet in Chile, Chavez in Venezuela, but there's some thread that ties them together, and that's what I try to highlight in my book.
Well, there are two regimes that have really described themselves as being on the left, and that is Chavez and Morales. Chavez in Venezuela, Morales in Bolivia.
Right. And there are certainly, if to the extent you want to paint a linear picture of left to right, they're probably on the further left side of the spectrum. But, they work very closely with the Cuban government, obviously. They have good relationships with Korea and Ecuador. Venezuela and Argentina have been working in very close cooperation. So I think, it gets very complicated how you divide and distinguish and what labels you want to apply to any one of these leaders.
Are you at all disturbed? Because you seem to have a certain amount of affection for Hugo Chavez by what seems to be a move toward a more autocratic approach?
Well, I think it's an issue. I assume you refer to his recent victory in constitutional reform that did away with term limits.
After it had been rejected earlier, he just keeps on coming back. And,
right.
And now seems to be intent on being reelected until reelected president for life.
Right. Well, that's what they say. You know, I don't think there's any real indication of that. What has happened is that the majority of Venezuelan people have voted time and time again to endorse President Chavez's presidency and the policies which his presidency promotes. I personally didn't think it was a good use of time or energy for the Venezuelan government to amend the Constitution. I think it would have been much more productive to train new leadership to replace Chavez, and as you said, to respect the outcome of the first referendum on constitutional reform.
You've met him.
Yeah, I spent some time working in the presidential palace in Venezuela as part of my research for my Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford.
You also worked for a foreign film crew in Venezuela?
I did, yep, as a fixer, helping them organize interviews and interpretation and all that.
And you took a journey with your mother, Bernadine Dorn, or your adoptive mother, into Colombia. Who arranged that trip?
Bernadine, my mom, has gone to Colombia on a number of human rights delegations. She's been invited by various NGOs and Colombian peace activists to come down as a foreign observer of their peace and human rights work. And she asked me to come along on this trip.
So where do you live most of the time now, here or there?
Right now I'm a student at the Yale Law School, so I live in New Haven, Connecticut.
But are your plans to go back to Latin America?
I certainly hope to. I love Latin America.
And where would you go? Where could you imagine yourself settling down?
I think I'd like to have a life that bridges the gap. I've always grown up, as I said, with a foot in two worlds, between prison and private school, between Chicago and Caracas, between Yale University and the University of Chile. So I'm trying to find a way to continue bridging that gap.
A caller wants to know if you met Barack Obama.
I grew up in Hyde Park, so it's a pretty small community.
And he was kind of friends, or at least he had contact with Bill Ayers. His disagreement over how much contact
it's so funny that issue's gotten this much exposure. And I think what's really interesting today is to look at what the opportunities available to the Obama administration in Latin America are, and there's myriad opportunities for him.
Your mother was paroled, as we said, in 2006. What's your father's situation?
His minimum sentence was 75 years to life, so he has a long way to go.
Chavez Bodine will be giving a talk and signing books this Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Yale Bookstore in New Haven. And then this Thursday at 7:30 at the Brecht Forum at 451 West Street here in New York. His book is called Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. It is published by Scribner's. And do you have any other books planned?
Always. I'm on the road a lot, and there's a big world out there, and I love to share my experiences. So I'm looking forward to the next project.
And what's your sense of the future for Latin America? Do you see it is moving in a good direction?
I'm optimistic. I think the reinvention of democracy around the region has been inspiring, and we have a lot to learn.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.